Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest today is Elaine Hall, the author of Now I See the Moon, A Mother, A Son, A Miracle. When her son Neil was diagnosed with autism, Elaine, also known as Coach E, a former Hollywood acting coach, took matters into her own hands and used her resources to guide him toward an increasingly independent life. In the process, she founded the Miracle Project, a groundbreaking organization that uses performing arts to connect with children with autism. She was also the subject of an Emmy Award-winning documentary, Autism, the Musical. Elaine is actually here in Dallas, Texas, as a keynote speaker attending the Autism Society 41st National Conference and Exposition. She and I will be discussing a story of hope, faith, miracles, and a story only a mother could tell. Good evening, Elaine. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you?
Oh, terrific, Johnny. I'm really, really happy to be here today. And it's really great that I'm talking to you and I'm in Dallas. It's really exciting.
It's very, very exciting. This is the first time. This is my 62nd show that I'm doing. And,
wow.
And guess what? We're doing it in the afternoon, in the evening, and I'm really excited that we're able to accommodate you, having you on our show. I really enjoyed reading your book. It's very, very exciting to have you with me.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You know, reading your book, I got the sense, and it just reminded me so much about the things that I went through in my life, and you took me on a wonderful spiritual journey, which I have not experienced in books that I've read for a long, long time. I do want to mention that because it truly is something that I really enjoyed. I literally sat down for 2 days and read it right through and enjoyed every minute of it, because here is someone that is truly touched somehow, somewhere, that even though you may not know it, but you were guided by some sort of a divine force, and you sort of like went along the way, you know, and that's very, very exciting.
Thank you so much. Yes, yes.
Let us begin go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say, you know, I think we all have that still small voice inside of us,
mm-hmm.
and that there are times when it's necessary to heed the call. And I got to admit, Johnny, there are times where I heeded the call, but I was kicking and screaming the whole way.
Don't we all do that, though? It's one of the things I agree. And then now I think the older we get, the more we realize that, okay, I give up. Go ahead. and
surrender.
Just go.
That's exactly it, the surrender, right?
Very true. Well, Elaine, let's start off by talking a little bit about yourself. Please walk us through your life's journey from childhood to the present moment. Now, you have a wonderful story to tell, and I want everyone to have a chance to listen to that.
Thank you. Well, I grew up in Maryland, and the thing I wanted more than anything in the world was to be normal. I wanted, like so many kids, you know, I wanted to fit in. And as hard as I tried to fit in, it just never quite worked. My family background, I'm a second generation from Russian immigrants and a Jewish background, and I was very petite. I still am. But in elementary school, even smaller, and I just really didn't fit in. My religious background was different than most of the other kids, and so at a very young age, I went to the moon as my guide,
mm-hmm.
and hence part of the title of the book, to direct me, and that was my friend, and I could talk to the moon could talk back and guide me. And what I loved more than anything was the creative arts, writing, singing, dancing. So I chose to study dance and music and drama and creative writing and philosophy and religion. When I went into my adult life, I became an acting coach for film and television, working with some of the brightest young stars, kids. I was a kids coach in Hollywood and worked CBS and Disney Pictures and lots of things. My world was quite big, very large. Then I married and on the outside looked like I had a really fine, successful life. But as you had mentioned earlier when we were speaking before, what I wanted more than anything was to be able to have a child of my own. Mm-hmm. And God had plans for me. I did get a child of my own, but it wasn't the way that I thought. I wasn't able to conceive biologically. My mom had taken a drug called DES when she was pregnant mm-hmm. with me. And when I was not able to, I had two ectopic pregnancies, miscarriages. And when I was ready to adopt, it was exactly what I needed and wanted to do. I boarded a plane and went to Russia. And because I figured my heritage was Russian. So mm-hmm. let's come full circle. My grandpa was an orphan in Russia when he came to the United States. And I wanted to kind of have my roots and went to Russia and adopted the most beautiful, beautiful little 23-month-old boy and mm-hmm. brought him with my then husband back to Los Angeles. So I was ready for normal. I was ready for carpool and soccer mm-hmm. and, you know, all those things that having a child will do for you in my vision. But that wasn't God's plan for me. And after my son was with me for less than a year, actually when I first brought him home, he was very ill. He had malnutrition and scurvy, and he was 23 months old, but he looked more like a 9 or 10 month old, liver toxicity. So I spent a long time just helping him to get healthy. And we did. He within a 6 months or so, he was extremely healthy. He looked like a surfer dude. Looked like a California boy. But he didn't catch up developmentally. He wasn't talking. There was no eye contact. He spun around in circles. He stared at his hand for hours at a time. He opened and closed cabinets. Now today, as I'm saying these things, and to your listeners, mm-hmm. you could say, those of you who know about autism, today you would go, oh, that child has autism. But this was 14 years ago. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it was before the surge of autism and the knowledge that we have today. And I didn't know from autism. I mm-hmm. made excuses for everything that he was doing. Mm-hmm. If he was staring at his hand, I said, well, he had no toys in mm-hmm. the orphanage. That was his only toy. Mm-hmm. If he banged doors, I said, that's because he can. He has freedom. But I did have to admit and finally reconcile that my son did indeed have autism. And I grieved more for my normal that I wanted mm-hmm. and rather than my son, because here I had this beautiful, incredible mm-hmm. little boy in front of me. It was really my own vision that I had to let go. And then jumped into the world of autism. I found a doctor in Maryland, Dr. Stanley Greenspan. I was living in Los Angeles, but flew to Maryland. And Dr. Greenspan had a methodology of working with children with autism, which was rather than to stop their seemingly bizarre behaviors, but rather to join it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So if my son Neil, would open and close cabinets, I would turn that into a game of peekaboo and hide behind the cabinet. And if it was a noise he was looking for, then we would bang things and make drums so that we created a connection together. Mm-hmm. And that kind of brings me up to that part of the mm-hmm. story. So,
yeah. It's been very exciting. I mean, I really enjoyed, as I mentioned to you, I really enjoyed reading your book because it's really from your heart, and you let everything out. But the good news is, it's a journey. It's a spiritual journey that I really enjoyed reading. Let's go back here real quick. How did you come up with the name Coach E?
Okay, when I was working in Hollywood, I was working on a film called The Flintstones, mm-hmm. And if anyone's seen it, there's Pebbles and Bam Bam.
Mm-hmm.
And for film, they often will hire twins to play one role. That way, there's more hours of a day that the child can be working. You can switch off twins.
Mm-hmm.
And the twins that were playing Pebbles were named Elaine and Melanie. So whenever the director would call for me, little Elaine, Pebbles Elaine, would run up to him. And so so the mom of Elaine, Pebbles Elaine, dubbed me Coach E. And
mm-hmm.
the name stuck. So that's who I am. I'm Coach E.
And I, when I read the book, that's what I envision. It's like funny. You were around a lot of funny situation, very warm, very loving, and it's fun. It's joyful. And knowing that, having heard you speak for a short while, that's who you are.
Well,
a bundle
of
high energy and fun. So that was kind of exciting. Now, you, as I mentioned before, you're a spiritual woman. And you have this wonderful conversation, a lot of things that has happened with you and that led you to adoption. I'll let you cover that. But one of the conversations that you have had with your dad was, I thought was very moving, was the fact that, I don't know when you recall it, but in the book where he mentioned to you something about there's all this sadness in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to finish that for me, I appreciate that.
My dad is really my teacher, and I was feeling very, very sad when I couldn't adopt a child. And I mean, I couldn't adopt when I couldn't give birth biologically. And I thought that the sadness would be there forever. And my dad said, honey, the sadness will always be there, but you're going to have so much joy around your heart that you're going to have to go in and look for it. And he was right. He was right. I think of my dad as one of the wisest men I know, and his name is Solomon. So there's no.
I know that it was like it was so interesting. You know, it's like wow, and it's all in the book, and I enjoyed that. And one of the other things that I enjoyed about your spiritual journey, as you were in the process of adopting Neil, is the fact that you had the holding the Torah. Story. That was a beautiful one, too. So perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I had come to peace with adoption in many ways. I, as a woman, I felt that, you know, adoption would be the, you know, a really good thing to do. As a mother, I wanted to mother anyway. Any way I could, I wanted to mother, so to have a child. But I had not come to peace with it within my own religion. In the Jewish tradition, they say, be fruitful and multiply. And I interpreted that I had to give birth biologically. And on the high holidays, my rabbi asked me to hold the Torah, which is the holy books, the scroll that we bring down through our tradition. And he told me to hold the Torah. And I grew up in a very religious family where women were not allowed to get that close to the Torah. So I was really nervous, and I said, well, what do I do? How do I hold it? And the rabbi said to me, hold it like a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And a week later, I went to his office, and I said, Rabbi, I want to adopt, but I feel like I'm a failure as a Jewish woman, and because I can't be fruitful and multiply. And the rabbi said to me, all creative works, the way we give to the world, whether we're teachers or nurses or writers or radio hosts, speakers, however we give to the world, we're being fruitful, and then multiplying. There's no greater gift, no greater way of being of service than to. Oh, I get teary thinking about it, but then to parent a child that has no parents, and then that is beyond. Being fruitful and multiplying, and as soon as I had that missing link, I was ready. I was ready to get on that plane, and there was no turning back after that.
It's a beautiful story, and that's why I wanted you to share with everyone, because I thought these are the things that real life, real people, real situation can relate to, because a lot of times we go through under tremendous amount of society pressure. In this case, like you're talking about, ethnic pressure of who we are. what our ethnicity stands for and everything else, and having that wonderful story, because when you talk about unconditional love, and that's what your book is all about, it transcends all cultures.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Love knows no shape or size or color or creed. I was gifted. My son gave me the gift of unconditional love, and that's I feel so blessed to be able to share it.
And you've been prepared. I mean, life is a journey. We walk through it, and we don't realize the things that we're going to be encountering tomorrow. What we're doing today is actually, in some ways, getting ready for tomorrow. And sometimes we don't realize that.
It's so true, Johnny. If I had all the things that my brain told me I needed and wanted, it's like I had no idea the plan that was in store for me, and it's so much greater and grander than anything my limited brain could have ever fathomed.
Coming back to Neil, how did you discover, or when in this case did you discover that he has autism? I know that you were looking at this sort of out of ordinary behavior pattern, so to speak. When did you actually discover him to be like, okay, this is it, and how did you react to it?
Well, in a Jewish tradition, when a child is born, there's a circumcision, it's called a bris. Mm-hmm. And since Neil didn't have that in Russia, we waited for a while and to have a religious ceremony and a neurological ceremony. Probably too much detail here. But anyway, we went to the doctor for a checkup so that he could have this procedure. And the doctor said, Elaine, Neil is not developing correctly. He's not making eye contact. He's not speaking. I think there's something wrong. You really need to get this checked out. And he didn't use, at that time to me, was the A word. He just said, get this checked out. And he had me take Neil a series of tests. And it was terrible. I mean, my poor sweet little boy, they had him, you know, can you stack blocks? And can you thread needles and beads through things? And, I mean, hours and hours of tests. And the results came out that he was severely mentally retarded, that he had severe autism. The suggestion was, why didn't they tell me, you know, when I adopted him, and is there a place where I can send him back to? And, you know, I was just like dumbfounded. You know, I'm like, this is my son. What are you talking about? But then I got the diagnosis of severe autism, and I had to accept it. And I didn't. I kept thinking he was going to outgrow it, just like he outgrew the physical ailments, the liver toxicity and, you know, and all that. I really thought that he was going to outgrow it. And I had to go through a grieving process with that, you know. I really grieved. I let myself cry and feel the feelings. And then just went into action, really went into action.
You had you apparently went through a tremendous amount of challenge in that time. Who gave you the courage to move on through these difficult times?
It was really prayer. It was really, really prayer. There was just this strong voice in my heart that talked really loud to me. And I would listen. You know, is in the beginning of the journey, I would hear the voice inside, but I wouldn't listen to it, you know. And then I'd fall apart and follow all kinds of things, and there would be shorter distances between the time I would listen to as where today it's like, the voice tells me what to do, and I'm very obedient. I just jump in and do it.
Well, one of the things that you've covered also is that there's so many different degrees of autism, because it's very tailored basically to individuals on what the degree of challenges, I guess, per se, per individual. And in this case, Neil had something very different in a way, to whereby it was not very well understood. And so you took the time and you had the patience, and all that came from that unconditional love, because you came in and you really literally wanting to solve something, to find out what's the core that is causing all this, and then you wanted to find solutions to it. One of the things that I like about what you mentioned is Neil had his Clint Eastwood moment, and that's the other thing I like about having you wrote in some wonderful flair about the Hollywood stuff that you work with. Tell us about that Clint Eastwood moment for Neil.
Well, you know, people were thinking that Neely was on his own planet and that he wasn't participating in the world, and yet I would notice things. Mm-hmm. I would notice sensitivities about him. And, you know, the Clint Eastwood moment, I love that. It's so, you're so perceptive to pick out these bits from the book.
Yeah.
Thank you, Johnny. We went to visit my cousin and her kids, and actually, this was my sister and her two children.
Mm-hmm.
And Neil really wasn't playing with them very much. They didn't know what to do with him. They didn't think he was really present. But then my nephew hit my niece.
Mm-hmm.
And so Neil went up to my nephew and slapped him. Like, taking care of, don't you hit the girl, you know?
Right,
it was
right.
Really beautiful. It was really beautiful. He was only 3 years old then, too. He was only three.
Right, right. And it was a natural instinct for him because he's operating within his own upper and lower limits, which we may not necessarily understand. And obviously
right.
No one understood at that time. Yeah.
That's right. He was protecting her. Yep.
Mm-hmm. It was a natural nurturing instinct on his end. That
yes. It,
in some ways is a whole lot higher level than, say, you and I would have done at our age or something like that, you know. So it's very difficult to say something like that. How about your family? How did they relate to your adopting a child with autism?
I'm going to go back to a comment that you just made that is
mm-hmm.
really so poignant, that Neil was reacting in a way that was much more sophisticated than most three-year-olds. And
that's correct. Mm-hmm.
So perceptive of you to notice that. And right, you know, another three-year-old wouldn't have taken that kind of caretaker sensitivity. And mm-hmm. part of that could have been from, you know, being raised for 2 years in an orphanage
mm-hmm.
where he was a little caretaker. I mean, he did take care of, you know, other kids and had to be a survivor. So that's, you know, really, really interesting. In terms of how my family reacted,
mm-hmm.
I think they just didn't get it. I have such a loving family, an incredibly loving family, and they just couldn't figure out, you know, how to relate.
Mm-hmm.
My dad is a big kid, and he just loves to play, and he would ruffle Neil's hair, you know, like, hey, buddy,
mm-hmm.
and Neil would start screaming, and so my dad would think he didn't like him, you know,
mm-hmm.
and...
Mm-hmm.
And my mom really kind of got him. She would just, my mom was such, may she rest in peace, she's such a peaceful person.
Mm-hmm.
She would just sit and let Neil come to her and
mm-hmm.
feed him, which he loved to eat.
Mm-hmm.
In her own way, I think she really got him in a different way. They couldn't figure out why he wasn't talking because people didn't know about autism then, you know, again, 14 years ago.
Right.
And they were worried, but they loved him. They really, really loved
them. And I think they were worried for you because they obviously want you to have a good life. But happiness is in the eye of the beholder.
Yes. I think they were worried and they were concerned. But I think they also saw the incredible joy that I got from everything that I was doing with Neil.
Mm-hmm.
It looked kind of bizarre on the outside.
And I know one of the... most tender moment for you in the book is when Neil called you mama, because that's one of the things that you were really working very hard and the timing was right when it happened. Tell us a little bit about that too.
Yeah, the words I had longed to hear my whole life were mama. And I worked with everybody else's kids, and that was a word Neil didn't speak, that he couldn't say. And every morning before, he'd always run into my room and want me to get out of bed, and I'd say, okay, if you want me to get out of bed, you gotta say mama. And I would touch his lips and mama. And he wouldn't say, he'd try, but nothing would come out. But I'd get out of bed anyway. I did it every single morning. And probably for about 6 to 8 months, whatever. When he was about 3.5 years old, I went to a conference in Maryland with Dr. Stanley Greenspan.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't seen him for 4 days. And my husband at the time flew him out to Maryland to meet with us because we were going to go see the doctor afterwards. And I hadn't seen him, missing him so badly. And we were meeting at a restaurant with my sister and her family, and I couldn't wait to get to the restaurant. And I walked to the restaurant. I see Neil in a little high chair at the table, and all of a sudden he jumps up out of the high chair and starts screaming, "Mama! Mama! Mama!" I bawled. It was worth every second of waiting for it.
There you go. I wanted you to share that because I think that's a beautiful moment. And if I'm not mistaken, of course, I'm not married yet, but probably kids say Dada first before they say Mama, isn't it? I'm not sure. Maybe I'm being biased.
Actually, I've heard that as well. I've heard the sound is an easier sound to produce than the mumma sound. So I've heard that as well. Yeah.
So you got a whole leg up there, you see. So I wanted that to be mentioned on the air because it was just a wonderful story. Now, during these challenging times in your life, too, because your mom was feeling sick and everything else, one thing that you wrote was very, very interesting because you were going through the phase where you are understanding and having a greater understanding of the relationship that you have with your mom. And I knew that she, in some ways, played a tremendous amount of role in your life in some ways. And one of the things that I enjoyed was the fact that you mentioned about St. Francis prayer in your book. Can you please enlighten us on that?
Sure. My mom and I, there was always a lot of love between us. We didn't have a lot in common, or so I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And all I wanted was for my mom to understand me. And, you know, I moved to Los Angeles, and I studied dance and singing and acting, and I was, you know, more of the creative, spontaneous type. My mom was very solid. Before marriage, she was a secretary, and then she was a homemaker and raised her children, and just a very solid, down-to-earth person. And what I wanted more than anything was for her to understand me. And when she got ill, the last year of her life, I was able to fly to see her every chance I got, and I was able to take care of her and love her and wash her feet. And what I learned was that beautiful line of St. Francis' prayer, which is seek first to understand, mm-hmm. then to be understood. And when I realized that my task was not to get my mom to understand me, but for me to understand her.
Mm-hmm.
And so our last months together were without any friction or difficulty, our last couple years together. And it was really more about me understanding and appreciating who she is, who she was, and the legacy she left me. She taught me how to be a mother.
Mm-hmm.
She taught me to put others first,
mm-hmm.
and how to be a friend. My mom had the greatest friends. Over 300 people came to her funeral, and she was not a dignitary in the traditional sense, you know. And it was because she just loved. She loved. She lived on the planet to love, and that was a gift she gave me. And I cherish it every minute, every day.
That's one of the reasons I brought this particular topic up, because for one thing, in the course of living, we eventually become our parents' parents. We will become their teacher, their coach, their counselor, and everything else. And then in the course of doing that, that's when we realize we understand them, and then in understanding them, we understand ourselves, like you had mentioned. And so that's the beauty of this whole thing. And also, not to mention that she was quite a unique person, because you guys were involved, even though you're all Jewish, you all were involved with celebrating Christmas for the neighbor next door and everything else. And I thought, and that, again, is out of being the approach of unconditional love to do that.
Absolutely. We used to bring gifts to families that were in need over the Christmas
mm-hmm.
holidays.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so funny. When I look back, I mean, we lived in a little teeny duplex in southern Maryland, and
mm-hmm.
barely, hardly, when I look back at my dad's income, and yet we always felt like we were wealthy because my mm-hmm. parents brought in the neighborhood for dinners and mm-hmm. took food to other people, and they were just so full of love that mm-hmm. where they decided to spend their time and energy was it being a service, that was their way of being in the world.
Right. And then you are at the right moment in your life with the things that you're doing now with autism and everything else. And my next question is, what compelled you to write this book?
Well, I got to tell you, Donnie, the book wrote me.
Mm-hmm.
I've had such an extraordinary life the past couple of years mm-hmm. to fill in the blanks. Once Neil was diagnosed, I wanted to do this new approach with Neil, which was to join his world. And mm-hmm. traditional therapists in Los Angeles thought that I was kind of a Looney Tunes. So I found my theater people, my mm-hmm. dancer, singer, writer, actresses, and I had a theater company called Kids on Stage, and I got all my theater people to join Neil's world and to be creative with him, and slowly, inch by inch, he emerged into our world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story that it felt like it needed to be told. Shall I go into the autism musical piece, or just the
yes,
the
yes. I mean, just yeah. go ahead. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, basically, we joined his world 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, until he gradually, inch by inch, emerged into ours. And I mean, he would be doing strangely bizarre things. Like, there's a time Neil had to just throw things randomly, and so we had a room where he could just throw, and we started just with cushy, you know, real soft
mm-hmm.
Stuffed animals and balls, and he would throw them random, and we would throw with him, and then
mm-hmm.
gradually it turned into appropriate, into basketballs and things like that, and basically helping Neil process and become part of the world. And he was able to go back to school when he was about 7 years old, and
mm-hmm.
it was time for me to go work and mm-hmm. get back to work. I had quit my job for 7 years and to be with Neil, and it was time to work again. I didn't know what to do, so I literally prayed every night and asked God what I was supposed to do. I didn't want to go back in the film business.
Mm-hmm.
That you know, can be long hours, 12-hour,
right.
14-hour days. So the answer came really strong to me to teach children with special needs acting, singing, and dancing. And that's why I said I was kicking and screaming, because I was saying, I don't know how to teach kids acting, singing, and dancing with special needs. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm an acting coach. My kids are the brightest, you know, and
right.
they became even stronger. Teach children with special needs, like just ordering me to do it. And I found out about a grant. Michelle Wolf in Los Angeles told me about a grant from the Jewish Community Foundation, and
mm-hmm.
I applied to the grant. It was beginner's luck. I'd never written a grant before in my life, and I found out about it. I started writing it on a Thursday. I found out that it was due the next day on
mm-hmm.
Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote it and turned it in right at the deadline on Friday, and fortunately got it. And I started what's now known as the Miracle Project, and
mm-hmm.
what the Miracle Project is a film and theater program for kids with autism and other special needs,
mm-hmm.
and they're typically developing siblings and peers. And really, it's a call out for community.
Mm-hmm.
Often, families with autism are isolated. They
mm-hmm.
spend most of their time in therapies. Like the typical child may go to basketball or baseball, where the child with special needs is going to see a therapist, you know, doing speech therapy, occupational therapy. And what we do at the Miracle Project is we combine all the protocols with all the kids together, and we join their world. Yeah, with, you know, 18 to 20 kids, and mm-hmm. and we have volunteers that are professional actors and singers and dancers, and we put on full-blown musicals every year. Mm-hmm. My first year, a group of filmmakers from mm-hmm. Then Cure Autism now Autism Speaks, mm-hmm. Saw what we were doing. I didn't think we were doing anything special because, again, I was not in the special needs world.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't know. And they saw what we were doing and asked if they could film it. Mm-hmm. And that became what's now known as the documentary Autism the Musical.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So getting back to why I wrote the book, after the film came out, mm-hmm. people wanted to start the Miracle Project in every community.
Right.
And I received over 7,000 emails, actually. And what I chose to do was to write my story.
Mm-hmm.
And by writing my story, hopefully to inspire others to listen to their voice and to see their lives in a different perspective and hopefully create miracle projects everywhere.
Right. Well, what I got from the projects that you're working on, the miracle project and so forth, in your book you mentioned about at one time it was about communication, because Neil or someone who is autistic, they have their own little world. And so basically, what are we doing to bridge that gap? And one of the things that you were taught, and these are by people that are leading experts at that time, which is, hey, get into their world and experience that. Because what happens is that from a simple thing that you mentioned about in your book about when Neil and you would go walking and you guys, he wanting to keep on looking at hubcaps. And to an ordinary people, say you and I, what the heck are you wanting to do to look at the car's hubcaps for? And one day you decide to do that, and then you saw a beauty in that which you would not have normally have seen if you have not done what he did. And once he had got that across to you, okay, let's move on. And so you had put a little bit of everything in combination, and what your project, what I see, is a wonderful thing where now I'm reaching slowly in, now I'm drawing you out, you know, like, okay, welcome to my world now. And that's what I got from this whole thing.
That is exactly it, Johnny. That's exactly it. So often with kids with autism, there's a tendency to yank them into our world.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned was rather to go into Neil's world, to see the world from his perspective. Mm-hmm. And when I see the world from his perspective, it's a glorious, amazing world.
Mm-hmm.
Like what you're talking about, the hubcaps. He wouldn't, every time I tried to get him to walk, he wouldn't walk. He just stopped at that hubcap.
Right.
And it was like, come on. And when I stopped to look at the hubcap, there's this reflection of the sun
mm-hmm.
that is in the metal that is just glorious.
Right.
And when I stopped to look at that, it opened my world
mm-hmm.
to such beauty of things we take for granted. And I think that's the other thing with now, the book Now I See the Moon, that there's so many things that if you have a typical child, you may take for granted, where with a child with special needs, I take nothing for granted. Everything is a miracle. Every
mm-hmm.
moment, every time he looks me in the eye, every time, you know, things people say he can't do and then he does.
Right.
Everything is a miracle. And the title, Now I See the Moon, is from a Chinese proverb,
mm-hmm.
My barn burned down, now I can see the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm hoping that my book does is instill hope and to help people see that, you know, your barn may be burning down, but now you can see the moon. Now you can see all the stuff is gone. Now you can enjoy the essence and the
right.
greatness that's always there.
And not only that, also is that we all have, whether we realize it or not, we have subconscious shields. And coming back to the same example, we talk about the hubcap, for example, this has got nothing to do with a child who is autistic. Just imagine, he is at that elevation. That's his height. That's what he sees the world at. And I know that, you know, you say you're not you're a petite person, but can you imagine if someone, a dad that's around 6'2", he walks and he sees the world from 6'2", and you have a child who is only, say, perhaps, 2 feet or 3 feet tall, he sees the world at that level. And so what you did when I read your book, it really create a unique scenario where, you know, you got to be mindful. What are we looking at here? And at a child at 3 or 4 or 5 years old, what are they looking at? And all they're trying to do is to get your attention to see, hey, this is what I see. Do you see what I see? And then eventually, and you change the dynamics, you know, by carrying the child on your shoulder and say, hey, this is what I see. You don't see what I see, but I'm about to bring you to what I see.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's really, like what you're saying, it's really for all children, mm-hmm. Not just kids with autism. When I was working in the film business, I worked with a lot of young children. They call me a baby wrangler. That was the term. And the whole thing that I did then was to see the soundstage and the set and the strange world of, you know, film from the child's perspective. Mm-hmm. So I was joining their world to help them integrate in this strange, bizarre world of a movie set. Mm-hmm. And for all parenting, if we can really, again, it's that Saint Francis. It's seek first to understand, then to be understood. You know, it's really that. You know, with parenting, to take some time during every day, 20 minutes a day, to get into your child's world. You know, we're so busy, like, hurry up, get ready, get dressed, brush your teeth.
Right.
You know, coming,
right.
Get
right.
ready. But what if we just went into their world? You know, 20 mm-hmm. minutes a day. How profound that connection would mm-hmm. be. See how they perceive it, and especially for children with autism. So mm-hmm. often there's these myths that kids with autism don't have emotions and don't want to be around other people. Well, I experienced that not to be true. I find that the children and teens, and now I'm, you know, through my speaking at different conferences around the country, I've befriended some wonderful adults with autism. I found them to be the most sensitive people I've ever known,
mm-hmm.
and that the withdrawal, the retreat that mm-hmm. that characterizes autism is often just a form of protection. It's a shield,
mm-hmm.
because the senses can be so overwhelmed and bombarded mm-hmm. by our typical world. And mm-hmm. so understanding that, you know, when you see a person that has autism, that not to be judgmental, but to be curious and understanding.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. What inspired you to take a leadership role in the autism and adoption community following Neil's adoption?
It took me, Johnny. I'd like to say that I just signed up and said it really took me. I feel that there's so much that needs to be told and helped. I mean, I through my work with the Miracle Project and my speaking, and I want to change the way the world perceives children with autism,
mm-hmm.
and I also want to help families that adopted parents, and I feel like Neil has given me this gift to
mm-hmm.
be able to speak out and speak loud, and you know, it's almost like talking to Carolyn Wilson, who is the
mm-hmm.
President of Autism Society of Los Angeles today,
uh-huh.
and you know, and Lori Guthrie here in Dallas,
mm-hmm.
who's starting the Rainbow Project, which is the
mm-hmm.
Miracle Project in Dallas, and it's really almost a civil rights issue,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that to be accepting of people exactly who they are.
Mm-hmm.
and providing opportunities for them. So
mm-hmm.
that's a real important piece for me in terms of the autism world. In terms of the adoption world, often parents do adopt challenging children.
Right.
And if I can help them in any way of being a voice to never give up, and I was telling friends of mine who are about to adopt, and they didn't know whether to adopt an older child or a younger child, and blah, 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 and the difficulties with an older child. And I said, you know, when you adopt a child, and probably it's the same with biological children, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have that experience. But for me, with adopting Neil, that it's not about me wanting him to love me. You know, mm-hmm. I don't bring a child into the world for them to love me.
Right.
It's an opportunity for me to love. And mm-hmm. when you adopt a challenging child, I think the opportunity for your heart to grow even grander mm-hmm. is so profound, because it's about just loving them no matter what. You know, no matter what, whether they ever say mama, or they ever say I love
right.
you, whether they, I mean, Neil used to break things, whatever, and it's just made it even more important to love him more. And so if I can, you know, help parents in that way, when their child is being their worst self, that's when they need the most love. And so that's kind of where I feel is my mission. And yet also for parents to learn to take care of themselves, because mm-hmm. if you're empty inside, there's
right.
nothing to give, nothing authentic to give. And so
right.
how do we nurture ourselves? My partner Diane Isaacs and I have started Miracle 360, which is about families with autism, and mm-hmm. and really it goes to families, you know, with any challenge. It's how important
right.
it is to nurture ourselves. And you know, on the airplane today, they said put your own oxygen mask on first before you
right.
put it on your child. So eating well, sleeping well, exercising, creating community. The Miracle Project creates community, and I think that's one of the most important things, besides putting on shows and singing and dancing.
Right.
We have a community where people are not alone, and it's just so important to have that, you know, create community like that.
Very true. I think you are doing all the things that's necessary. Interestingly enough for me, it's not just for autistic family that has autistic children, because what you did is created a very powerful way of communicating with a child, or in this case, for that matter, anyone. Because are we seeking first to understand and then be understood, or we just have our own, you know, mind and saying, well, this is the way it is, and that's it, nothing else is acceptable. So what you are teaching actually is to be mindful. And that brings to the core the fact that you talk about that. I think the Miracle Project, your core philosophy is miracle-mindedness. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, that's exactly it. Miracle-mindedness is about being present in the moment,
mm-hmm.
about finding that place of calm inside, about not reacting,
mm-hmm.
and being able to love from a well, from a source, and to not take anything for granted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's a gift that I've gotten, you know, with Neil, is not mm-hmm. taking anything for granted. And, you know, with our miracle-mindedness, it's reminding ourselves. We even have bracelets with butterflies on it to remind us.
Yeah.
To let things evolve in their own time, you know,
mm-hmm.
God's time, not my time, and all
right.
of that is about being, you know, being miracle-minded.
You talk about things that, you know, you came full circle, because you involved back with the Vista group, that way you started out about adopting a child. Tell us a little bit about the Vista Inspired Teen Program.
Mm. It's really pretty amazing. I adopted Neil from Vista Del Mar when he was 2 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then on his 12th year, I got a call from Vista Del Mar. They were looking for someone to start a bar bat mitzvah, which is a religious education program for kids with autism. And they had heard about what I do and asked if I could do that. And I was fortunate to find some clergy to work with me, and we developed a whole bar and bat mitzvah program for children with special needs, and also bring the Miracle Project there, which is now it's called the Vista Inspire program.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, 12 years, you know, 10 years later, actually, I was able to start a program for Bar Mitzvah, which just happened to be Neil's Bar Mitzvah year. So he was the very first child to be Bar Mitzvah there. And now we have this whole program, religious education and self-advocacy program that the Daniel Jordan Siddle Foundation has helped us with, and the Jewish Community Foundation has helped us build this whole program there for kids, as well as a theater program. Mm-hmm. And then we have the Inspired Teens, and the Inspired Teens are local teenagers that that volunteer in our programs and raise funds and awareness and go out into their schools to raise the consciousness about special needs. And our teens work with them. So our teens have the self-advocacy where they learn how to say who they are in the world. And it's been pretty amazing. And we've created a CD of music pairing celebrity artists with kids with autism. Mm-hmm. It's called Fly. And actually go to flyintoautism.com, and that has all kinds of information about our CD. We've got Jack Black on it, and
he's a funny guy. He's a really funny guy. I'm sure he enjoys working with kids.
He was amazing. He was amazing with Wyatt, and Holly Robinson Pete sang on our album, and Kira Sedgwick, and Chaka Khan, and and so doing duets with our kids, Rev Run. So that's also part of, changing teens' culture, changing the way they look at kids that are different. We figured if they think a kid with autism is singing with Jack Black, it's got to be pretty cool.
That's right.
So, so those are some of the projects that are in the works.
Well, I do want to go back to your book. I think one of the beautiful things that I got from your book is you have this wonderful story to talk about, and which you mentioned that in your book about meeting your current husband. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. Hi. God works in mysterious, wonderful ways. I went through divorce with my first husband, and as all divorces, it wasn't pleasant, and I never thought I would ever marry again. And I was very fine, just Neely and I. And then I met my now husband at the Sound of Music sing-along at the Hollywood Bowl, and we sat next to each other and just sang. And after our first date, it was the only date I'd been on in like 20 years. After our first date, we just fell madly in love. And he's actually a therapist. He's a play therapist. He works with kids with special needs. He's and families. And he's an amazing cook. He's a gourmet cook. Which is, people know me, I burn boiling water, I burn water, so that's a good thing. And he's just my light and my love, and is a wonderful role model for Neil, and as are Neil's coaches. I want to do a shout out to Zach Wimpy, who lives in Dallas, Texas, and he's one of Neil's coaches. He's been our coach for many, many years, and he's in the book. So any friends of Zach that happen to be listening right now, thank you, Zach, for moving to Los Angeles.
I read about that. And again, you talk about one of the things you mentioned in your book, and of course that's what you're doing right now with your Miracle Project, is to build communities so that everyone can get plugged in. And that's what I like about what you're doing, and you're developing that in a wonderful way, because it's the biggest thing that I think happens here is that for whatever reason, people need to understand you are not alone.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly it. There's a whole community, and I welcome you to join me. I have a blog on CoachEOnAutism.com. And we read parent stories on there a lot, and themiracleproject.com is the website, and you're not alone. There, you're not alone, and that's the thing, about having a Miracle Project. I mean, that's my dream, is to be able to serve the need to create Miracle Projects in every community, because Neil and I, we have more friends than we know what to do with. We share holidays together and birthdays, and we have a whole community of people who really get us,
right,
and don't judge us.
Right.
And I think that's what everybody needs. I know I sure needed it.
How has writing this book impacted you personally? The fact that now you've finished it, I know it just came out this month, but how has it impacted you? How has it changed certain things within you? How does it move you spiritually? Because you're a very spiritual person.
Great question, Johnny. It just came out last week, and as you know, in terms of spirituality, the day it came out, I went to a meeting, and there, sitting next to me, was a woman who had inspired the title. Her house had burned down about 15 years ago in the Malibu fires, and I saw her like 15 years ago, 2 days after. And her house had burned down, and she was, you know, very distraught, very sad. But she said, "My barn burned down. Now I can see the moon." She said,
"Wow."
Everything, you know, and 15 years later, I ran into her the day my book was published, the day it hit the bookstores.
Sounds to me, I need to get over to the Hyatt and give you a hug so that someone that good
luck.
Well, rub up on me.
I'm telling you, so if anything, writing this book and then the day it was in bookstores, that happened, what it tells me is that there is a divine plan at work here.
Right.
And it's just up to me to listen and not get too busy or worried, fearful, and just really listen, because there is a divine plan. And when I look back over my book, I see how everything lined up to perfection. And then it continues. It's not like, oh, it did, and then, you know, I'm dropped now. No. Every moment is a blessing. And I'm hoping that my book will be helpful. That's my prayer, is that it'll help others.
Wonderful. How can someone buy your book and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, we have a website, nowiseethemoon.com. And that'll tell us, you know, every place I'm going to be. I'm at the Autism Society of America. I'm the keynote speaker tomorrow for their theater workshop, and then speaking again on Friday, and that's at the Hyatt Regency. Visit us on nowiseethemoon.com. Books are sold at, you know, Barnes and Noble and Amazon, and if you go to the nowiseethemoon.com site, it'll show you all the other places too that you can get a book.
Fantastic. We're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners?
I'm sorry, say it again, a what?
Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners? We're coming close to the end of the show, and I usually have my guests give us a wonderful recipe for living that she feels like that will help all of us.
My recipe for living is to trust in the imperfections of our world and to know that there's no accidents. It's all about perception. And to listen to the child that does not speak.
Wonderful. That's beautiful. Well, Elaine, thank you for the great recipes for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning at our regular time. My guest will be Alex Strauss, author of How I Got a Guy, Have I Got a Guy for You? True Stories of Well-Meaning Mismatched Dates Set Up by Moms. As you would understand it, the good news is you got a date, but the bad news is your mom set it up for you. Mom swears that she found the right one for you, but how you ended up in a bad date, she doesn't understand that. So anyway, we're going to cover that next week. Please join me and Alex as we discuss her mischievous collection of true stories that exacerbate the mother-daughter bond with a flair of humor and a touch of tenderness. For additional information about this show, future shows, and for my recipes for living, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com, and you can also follow me on Twitter. Thank you again for listening. Have a great week. Elaine, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you.